sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear part of an article about an Italian ex-president who claims that the CIA and the Mossad, which is the Israeli intelligence agency, ran 9/11. And then you'll hear the first of a four-part speech by Michael Rupert on the CIA, drugs, Wall Street, and the 9/11 connection. And I'll close the show today with an update of events taking place on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And so let's get started with the article. Here it is. Italy ex-president, CIA, and Mossad ran 9/11. This appeared in the Auburn Journal, a California newspaper, on September 18, 2009. Former Italian president Francesco Cossiga has told Italy's oldest and most widely read newspaper that the 9/11 terrorist attacks were run by the CIA and Mossad, and that this was common knowledge among global intelligence agencies. Cossiga was elected president of the Italian Senate in July 1983 before winning a landslide election to become president of the country in 1985, and he remained until 1992. Cossiga's tendency to be outspoken upset the Italian political establishment, and he was forced to resign after revealing the existence of and his part in setting up Operation Gladio. This was a rogue intelligence network under NATO auspices that carried out bombings across Europe in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Gladio's specialty was to carry out what they termed false flag operations, terrorist attacks that were blamed on their domestic and geopolitical opposition. In March 2001, Gladio agent Vincenzo Vinciguerra stated in sworn testimony, "You had to attack civilians, the people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people, far removed from any political game. The reason was quite simple, to force the public to turn to the state to ask for greater security." Cossiga first expressed his doubts about 9/11 in 2001 and is quoted by 9/11 researcher Webster Tarpley saying, "The mastermind of the attack must have been a sophisticated mind, provided with ample means not only to recruit fanatic kamikazes, but also highly specialized personnel. It could not be accomplished without infiltrations in the radar and flight security personnel." Coming from a widely respected former head of state, Cossiga's assertion that the 9/11 attacks were an inside job and that this is common knowledge among global intelligence agencies is illuminating. It is one more eye-opening confirmation that has not been mentioned by America's propaganda machine in print or on TV. Nevertheless, because of his experience and status in the world, Cossiga cannot be discounted as a crackpot. And now you're going to hear the first part of a speech by Michael Rupert. Michael Rupert ran a website called FromTheWilderness.com. His articles are still archived on the From the Wilderness website. His offices were burglarized in June of 2006, and he left the country after that and was living in Venezuela and Canada, and he'd been very ill. He seems to have recovered and is now in hiding and fears for his life. In a September 29, 2008 posting on his website about the financial meltdown, he also wrote the following. "I am in personal danger now, but it doesn't matter. I have broken an unspoken deal with the government to remain retired and not speak out. The legal harassments against me continue, and I have just now crossed my own Rubicon. I am now preparing for physical attacks in the hopes that they do not occur. You who know how right I have been can help protect me by speaking my name in public, by writing to media outlets, to Congress, and telling them about crossing the Rubicon and our incredible record at From the Wilderness." When he speaks of crossing the Rubicon, he's referring to the book he wrote in 2004, which has been described this way: a superbly detailed scrutiny of the events of 9/11. The book also ranges across the terrain of rapidly diminishing hydrocarbon energy supplies, geopolitics, narco-traffic, intelligence, and militarism, without which 9/11 cannot be understood. And so here's the first part of a speech given by Michael Rupert in 2002 called CIA, Drugs, Wall Street, and the 9/11 Connection.
Michael Rupert is one of the most outspoken commentators into the true nature of what's happening behind the scenes, behind the newspaper, behind the media, what's actually going on in our world today as far as government and manipulation of social change. He's an honors graduate of UCLA in political science, and he's a former Los Angeles Police Department narcotics investigator. In 1977, he discovered evidence of CIA trafficking in drugs, and after attempting to expose this, he was forced out of the LAPD in 1978, in spite of earning the highest rating reports possible and having no pending disciplinary actions against him. Since then, he's continued to speak out and to uncover more and more information and to put together the pieces of a puzzle, which he will explain to you today. He's going to be speaking primarily about the events leading up to and following September 11th. Michael Rupert.
This is Mike Rupert. I'm the publisher and editor of From the Wilderness. We're a monthly newsletter and a large website that's read by 20 members of the U.S. Congress, the intelligence committees of both houses, professors at 12 universities in the U.S. and Canada, also just a great many people who are thoroughly dissatisfied with the kind of information that's being fed to them about what's going on in the world today. We've been publishing for 4.5 years now. We have a very large website at fromthewilderness.com, just like it sounds. We're getting about 5,000 plus visitors a day to our website to read our stories that are feeding you news and food for your brain that's not junk food, that's telling you how things really work. What we do is we build a map. Most of you have seen those old-fashioned maps from the 1600s, 1700s, and there was one that the King of Spain had that showed that California was an island, and he was dumping out tons of money to his explorers to go out and investigate and explore, and they all came back empty-handed, and they said, "Majesty, we've sailed around the island of California, and there's nothing there." And finally, the king got wise, and he said, "Burn the map." The funny thing was is that his explorers started coming back with gold and treasure and lots of good stuff. And so we're living in a world today where if you're any kind of a sentient being who is not totally brainwashed, you look at the events, especially since 9/11, and you have a lot of questions. And it's like reading a bad map, you know, where you get a map to a party and you follow all the directions and it says you're supposed to be at 51st and June Street, and you look up and the street sign says 114th and Broadway, and, you know, you get this real sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach. Well, that's a bad map. That's called cognitive dissonance, and that's the world that we live in today if you believe all the stuff that the mainstream media tells you. We've been publishing for 4.5 years. We originally started writing about the role of the international drug trade in the world economy, something that people just didn't think about. We happened to be right on the money because years ago when I was a Los Angeles police narcotics detective, I had seen CIA personnel involved in the drug trade with my own eyes, and that eventually ended my career as I tried to expose it. I also was an honor graduate in political science from UCLA, and I was either blessed or cursed, depending upon how you look at it, to have grown up in a family with lots of ties to the CIA and the national security establishment. But I started seeing a different map some 25 years ago. And 4.5 years ago, after having been public for many years in opposition to CIA and the drug trade, we started publishing From the Wilderness. And we were in a place where, having looked at many aspects of covert operations and having looked at many aspects of geopolitics and how the drug trade works in the economy and how public opinion is massaged, controlled, and manipulated, we had our track shoes on with 3 years of publishing experience by the time September 11th rolled around. And we are probably the best known website on the planet post 9/11 for exposing and writing about the lies of 9/11. And there are some great lies. We've had a very strict journalistic policy, of course, that we do not under any circumstances publish or print anything that hasn't been sourced. I source everything that I write. Although we've published some 60, 70 articles post 9/11 on events all over the world, the centerpiece of our work has been a timeline. I took the title for the timeline from one of my favorite TV shows from the 1950s, because early on, the Bush administration position was just nonsense. I mean, I could look at other news stories, I could look at certain events, and I could say, these guys are either smoking something or they're just lying to us. And so the title of our timeline was, "Oh, Lucy, you got a lot of explaining to do." That's, of course, from Lucille Ball. And we have now some 86 items in that timeline. And you can read the timeline for yourself at the website fromthewilderness.com. But there's a whole lot more about 9/11. As opposed to the bad map, and you all understood what I was talking about when I told you about the bad map, there's a good map, you know, where you follow the directions for a long time and it says you're supposed to be at 12345 Willoughby Street. And you follow the map and you're at 12345 Willoughby Street. And you get this sense of the supreme animal being on top of the mountain, screaming victory because, you know, the world worked the way you thought it did. And what we're about is giving you a good map. And the map about 9/11 is very scary because the first thing that we have to overcome in most cases with most people is not anything except for denial, which is not a river in Egypt. What we have to overcome is people's unwillingness to let go of an old idea that somehow the world is full of Santa Clauses, Easter bunnies, tooth fairies, and a lot of things that just ain't so. People ask, what's the main reason behind 9/11? Now, we have taken the position from the wilderness that the Bush administration had complete foreknowledge of the attacks of September the 11th and allowed the attacks to happen for the purpose of mobilizing American and world popular support for a military occupation of Central Asia. Now, the first stumbling block that we come across with people when I try to explain this is they want just one reason. Don't bother me with two reasons why they would do this, or three. I just want one reason. And I say that's not true. The first and most important reason that I talk about is oil. But that's not all. So I say oil, and everybody says, okay, it's about oil. And I say, no, wait a minute, it's not just about oil, it's about oil and drugs. And they say, okay, it's about oil and drugs. And I say, no, wait a minute, it's about oil and drugs and geopolitics. And then, you know, it gets like too big to eat from the old Rodney Allen Rippy hamburger commercials they used to have in the 70s where this little boy picked up this great big Whopper at Burger King, you know, and he couldn't get his hands. Too big to eat. Well, it's not too big to eat. And that's why you have to make the map work, because all of these things come together and we see them coming together in world events post 9/11. Before I go any further, let me give you a piece of your map which is going to change the way you think about things fundamentally right off the bat. We're going to talk about the Central Intelligence Agency. You're going to know why. Well, this is very important because I'm going to give you a piece of a map that you'd never seen before, probably never thought of before. The Central Intelligence Agency is not what you see on television, and it certainly ain't what you see in the movies. It was created in 1947 by the National Security Act of 1947. Now, the National Security Act of 1947 was written by a man by the name of Clark Clifford. Clark Clifford was a good friend to LBJ and to Harry Truman. He was Secretary of Defense under LBJ. But his real profession was that he was a Wall Street lawyer and a banker. As a matter of fact, in 1990 or so, Clark Clifford is the man who brought a very legendary drug bank called BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, onto American shores before it was exposed as laundering hundreds of billions of dollars of drug money. And he brought that bank to America. That's just one connection. But then we go to two brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles. John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State for Dwight Eisenhower. Alan Dulles, he'd been the OSS station chief in Bern, Switzerland. That's the spy forerunner of CIA going back to World War II. Alan Dulles was the CIA director under Eisenhower and John Kennedy. John Kennedy fired Alan Dulles. And Alan Dulles wound up running the Warren Commission after John Kennedy was assassinated. Nothing suspicious there. Now, they designed the CIA. They told Clark Clifford how to write it. They collaborated with it. Guess what their profession was? They were both Wall Street lawyers at the Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, which is today probably the single most powerful law firm on Wall Street. It's, by the way, the firm that represents Enron. Nothing suspicious there. If we go a little further, we come to a guy by the name of Bill Casey. And during Iran-Contra, Bill Casey was Ronald Reagan's CIA director. He was creepy. Kill the commies, smoke the cigars, do anything dirty and nasty you got to win the war. And one thing that's unusual about Bill Casey is that under his tenure as DCI, DCI, by the way, is the Director of Central Intelligence, American cocaine consumption went from about 75, 80 metric tons in 1979 to 600 metric tons at the peak of the Contra War in 1987. Bill Casey was tied to all kinds of dirty, corrupt things. He died in office. He had a brain tumor. But you'll never guess what Bill Casey did before he was DCI. For Richard Nixon, he was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the U.S. government body that polices all stock transactions. If you've been following the market lately, that might be a little suspicious to you. But it's going to get worse real quick. Because when Bill Casey was DCI, he had a general counsel at CIA by the name of Stanley Sporkin. That's the top lawyer at CIA. And guess what Stanley Sporkin's job had been before he went to the CIA? Well, he was the general counsel for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Oh my God, we're starting to have what we call clues building up here. Now, if you go a little bit further, the general counsel at the CIA, after Stanley Sporkin left in the late 80s, was a guy by the name of David Daugherty. Now, guess what David Daugherty does today? David Daugherty is the executive vice president of the New York Stock Exchange for enforcement. And then we have a guy today in the number three position at CIA headquarters. His name is A.B. Buzzy Krongard. A.B. Buzzy Krongard joined the CIA in 1998, and he was promoted to ex-dir, that's what they call him at CIA, in January of 2001 by President Bush. Buzzy Krongard was an investment banker. He headed a firm called Alex Brown, which was acquired by Bankers Trust and then by Deutsche Bank, and it's now the private banking arm of Deutsche Bank to handle mega-wealthy clients. So, as a matter of fact, guess what? Six out of the first seven DDIs, that's the second highest position at CIA, Deputy Director of Intelligence, went directly from Wall Street to the CIA. Now, I bet you're starting to look at the CIA in a whole new light now, aren't you? I hope so. Now, if we come a little further, let's talk a little bit about oil. And here I have to tip my hat to a great journalist by the name of Seymour Hersh, who has broken a great many stories in his long career. Hersh has been a little soft on 9/11, but just before the attacks on 9/11, you know what? He wrote an incredible story in the New Yorker magazine called The Price of Oil. What he did was, he documented how, after the fall of the Soviet Union, almost all of the world's major oil companies, and here I'm talking about Chevron, Texaco. By the way, did you know that Condoleezza Rice, our national security advisor, came to the Bush administration from Chevron, and guess what her area of expertise was? Kazakhstan. That's in Central Asia, right next to where we're fighting right now. Chevron, Texaco, BP, Amoco, Exxon Mobil, Total, Fina, Elf, the biggest of the big oil companies, all sunk billions and billions, there's that Sagan thing again, billions and billions of dollars into Central Asia to buy, bribe, whatever they had to do, equity rights, into the largest remaining untapped oil and gas reserves on the planet. Now, they had a couple of problems. First of all, as Cy Hersh documented brilliantly, ExxonMobil bribed the president of Kazakhstan, which is a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They also, in 1997, because they couldn't get any of the oil out, you know, you have to have like a pipeline or something to get the oil out of there, they engaged in an illegal oil swap with Iran, because we can't do business with Iran. They did that in 97. But the problem was this, that all of these major, big old, huge, monster oil companies had committed, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars in cash to own oil, to develop oil in Central Asia, but they couldn't get any of it to market, meaning they couldn't monetize the investment. They couldn't build a pipeline north through Russia. There was the Russian mob there. It was unstable. The Russian government wanted to control the area that had once been part of the Soviet Union. It was too expensive and too long because the major markets were in China and Japan. They couldn't build a pipeline west because you would have had to go through Chechnya and Georgia and Azerbaijan and Iran. Well, you can't go through Iran. That's illegal. And you would have had to go through all these territories like Kosovo, maybe, that are all full of rebels and very unstable. No way you could do that because your pipeline would probably be blown up. And you couldn't go east. 6,000-7,000 miles across China was just too far to go. But you could go south. It was only 11, 12, 1300 miles from the rich gas fields in Turkmenistan and the Tengiz oil fields and the other oil fields in Kazakhstan to go south to the Pakistani coast where you could put it all on tankers because the U.S. controls the high seas, sail it around to China and Japan, and control the sale of it and make all the money from it. The only problem was you had to go directly through Afghanistan. But the plan had been there. Now, we talk in our lectures, and it's extremely well documented in the congressional record, in any number of books, in the contracts are still in existence, that UNICAL had had contracts to develop pipelines south across Afghanistan or a gas pipeline in a southeasterly direction. Now, there was another little wrinkle in this problem here, in that there was a company called Enron. You've heard of them, I hope. I hope you didn't have any stock in Enron. Enron had put $3 billion in cash to build an electrical generating station in the city of Dabhol, India, that would service Bombay. They were going to get their cheap gas from Qatar. But in 1998, that deal fell through. They lost access to the Qatari gas. But they had a plan to build a gas pipeline in a southeasterly direction across Afghanistan from Turkmenistan to connect up to the Indian pipeline system at the Indian border. And that was the only way that the Dabhol generating station could have ever generated profitably enough energy to sell. The Indian government wouldn't let it do it any other way. It was not feasible. And Enron was in deep trouble because everybody realized there was only one problem to turning all this oil and gas into money, and it was called the Taliban. Now, surprisingly, for a long period of time throughout the Clinton years and into the early part of the Bush administration, although the cards were pretty much cast by that time, people had tried to cultivate the Taliban. The BBC told us that in 1997, UNICAL flew representatives of the Taliban down to their Texas headquarters for a barbecue. Hey, come on down. We'll do a sheep and we'll figure out how to do this pipeline. We'll cook up the sheep real good. And we'll, you know what? It didn't work. The Taliban wanted too much money. Apparently, that's what the BBC story said. But the Taliban also wanted to take oil and gas out for use by the Afghani people in Afghanistan. So in that context, the Taliban proved to be a major stumbling block. And in 1998, a guy named John Maresca, who was an executive vice president of UNICAL, testified in Congress that until the Taliban was removed, none of the pipelines were going to get built. Now, in 1998, Bill Clinton launched some cruise missiles at the Taliban, and UNICAL backed out. They just said, we're not going to get this pipeline built. And on the face of it, you might think, okay, well, gee, that's an interesting part of the story. Okay, I'm understanding now, because we have documented it from the wilderness now. This is being taped in the late summer of 2002. And what we know now is that Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, they are all signing contracts and treaties to build pipelines hand over fist. The World Bank has opened offices in the region to help fund the pipelines. Turkmenistan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan have just signed a three-country treaty, which you can read online. You can find it at our website, to complete the natural gas pipeline by January of 2005. That's about 2 years. The oil pipelines are being discussed, and there's a flurry of activity all throughout the region. I wish I could tell you that it was just that simple, but it's not. Also, what you need to understand is that there was a book written about 5 years ago in 1997 by Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins. He also was an intelligence advisor to Ronald Reagan and to George Bush, the first. And he is also a co-founder with David Rockefeller of the Trilateral Commission. If you don't know what the Trilateral Commission, you ought to take a moment to look it up on the web. Very, very powerful, influential, moneyed people. And this book, the book is called The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. Zbigniew Brzezinski, B-R-Z-E-Z-I-N-S-K-I, is how you spell his last name. And you can find it on any major book site. He says very clearly that the key to America's primacy in the 21st century is the control of the Eurasian continent. Now, that's everything from Eastern Europe all the way to the Pacific Ocean, moving east across Russia and China. It is all of the Middle East and includes most of the Indian subcontinent and all of Central Asia. That's Eurasia, is what he calls it. And he says the key to controlling Eurasia is the control of Central Asia, specifically Uzbekistan. But what he's talking about is that little cluster of nations that we all call the stands. Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, all of the stands. But he says Uzbekistan's the key, Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. And Uzbekistan is just north of Afghanistan, and it's coincidentally the first place where Bush officially announced that we were sending troops. after the attacks on the World Trade Center. We were already there, as a matter of fact. Leaving that aside, Brzezinski said, and he writes throughout the book about pipelines and pipelines and pipelines, but he also says important minerals, including gold and resources and wealth and so on and so forth. And he talks about how China desperately needs the oil and gas. Early on in the book, he says, American popular support for World War II occurred largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Later on, he says that democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization, that the sudden threat, the sudden insecurity, the sudden fearfulness that is necessary to mobilize a populist democracy to basically scare the poop out of them. That's basically what he said. And later on, toward the end of the book, he says clearly that the public would not support the military intervention necessary to accomplish these tasks without a massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Now, all this information is on my website. You can read the quotes and everything else. It's all right there. But what's even scarier about this book, The Grand Chessboard, is that you get it, you open it up, you look at it, and there's a map in there of where the next world conflict is going to be. And the map is, boom, right smack dab, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, right where we are now. He says that's the place where the battle to control the world is going to take place. And that's a five-year-old map. So that would kind of rub against the notion that, gee, in 98, the Taliban just got out of hand and da-da-da-da-da, because Brzezinski clearly indicates that this war is being planned for a long time, and there are other events which indicate that it has been. For example, isn't it strange that on September the 11th, we had Operation Swift Sword, which the British had planned for 4 years, and it was the largest British deployment of troops since the Falkland Islands War, the largest armada since the Falkland Islands War. All the troops were in place, the ships were ready to leave harbor, and it was all set to go, been planned for 4 years, on September the 10th. Before the attack. Isn't it strange that in Operation Bright Star in Egypt, we had 17,000 U.S. troops along with 23,000 NATO troops in Egypt, locked and loaded, already with their tanks and guns and everything already in place in Egypt? Isn't it strange also that two U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups just happened to be sitting right off the Pakistani coast on what was not a normal rotation? That's what they call it when one carrier battle group trades with another, but that's not where they usually did it, but they just happened to both be there at the same time, sitting off the Pakistani coast. Some of these things make you start to raise questions. By the time you're through listening to all of what we do here, you're going to say, wait a minute, I have to revise my map. Because if you have to revise your map, then you have to undertake certain other things. It becomes incumbent upon you to change the way you view, act, and swim in the ocean that you call your world. You can't swim with the fish like you used to swim once you know this stuff. That's my purpose, because we can change the world, because the world is not a healthy place to live anymore.
You have just heard the first part of a four-part speech by Michael Ruppert. Tune in next week to hear the next part of the speech. To learn more about Michael Ruppert, you can go to his website, fromthewilderness.com. And now for the 10th anniversary events. Locally, on Saturday, September 10th, we'll be sponsoring a day-long 9/11 movie marathon in the Auerbach Auditorium at the University of Hartford from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. It's free and open to the public. And in Toronto, Canada, from September 8th through the 11th, hearings will be conducted at Ryerson University. They will involve the serious, careful, and informed consideration of the best evidence that has been discovered in the 10 years since the 9/11 events occurred. For more information, their website is torontohearings.org. Tune in next week to hear about the events going on in New York City on the 10th anniversary. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.